This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
Nearly 30 years ago, on December 26, 1980, former RAF Bentwaters Staff Sergeant James W. Penniston was RAF Woodbridge Security Supervisor. Jim was 26 years old then and had been in the U.S. Air Force since 1973, after graduating from Freeport High School in Freeport, Illinois. After midnight, Sergeant Penniston received a radio call from Central Security Control, asking him to go to the RAF Woodbridge East Gate. When Sergeant Penniston arrived, he could see fiery reddish-orange light in the trees, assumed it was a crashed airplane on fire, and asked law enforcement supervisor, Staff Sergeant Bud Steffens, when did it crash? But Steffens said it did not crash, it landed. Puzzled, Sergeant Penniston called the 81st Police Squadron shift commander, Lieutenant Fred Skip Moran, and asked for an eastern radar check. Lieutenant Moran told Sergeant Penniston there was an object over the base and that something had disappeared off radar. That convinced Lieutenant Moran to give Sergeant Penniston permission to go off base to investigate. Penniston wanted Steffens to go with him into the woods, but Steffens did not want to leave base property. So Airman John Burroughs volunteered to join Sergeant Jim Penniston and Airman Ed Kavansak. The three men drove in a pickup as far as they could to the trees, parked and walked closer to the mysterious, colorful lights. Their radios were interrupted by unusual static, and Sergeant Penniston asked Kavansak to go back toward the truck and act as a radio relay with Central Security Control. Retired Staff Sergeant Jim Penniston begins now with his and John Burroughs' approach to the bright lights in Rendlesham Forest.
It was apparent that it wasn't an aircraft crash. There was no fire. There was no fumes or anything like that from anything burning. What it was a very bright light illuminating from the forest floor.
Color?
Bright white.
So it's no longer the red, the orange, and the blues. It is now only white.
Correct. Very hard to see at that point in time.
It was so bright.
Yeah, it was very luminous, yes.
Do you remember Airman First Class John Burroughs is the only person with you at that point?
That's correct. It was John and I, and when we approached the craft, what I wanted to do is to establish what I had is a craft of unknown origin sitting in front of me, and I was going to ascertain whether or not that this was hostile or a threat to the resources on the base.
What are you seeing in the light with your own eyes and mind?
It was a triangular craft. The fabric of the craft was black like glass. And then throughout the fabric of the craft, there was some coloring, lighting, varying from saucer shape to pie-shaped circles that moved around the craft. They were colored, some were red, blue, some yellow, or orange, I guess more orange. John is still with me, and I start taking observations in the notebook to coordinate the time I was there and what my actions were.
If you could give us a few more details about this black, glassy triangle, that you are seeing what look like changing geometric patterns of different colors below the glass or above the glass?
Predominantly below the glass on the underside of the craft, and then occasionally moving around the upper side of the craft itself. It appeared that the coloring was part of the actual craft fabric. It made no sense. I've never seen anything that had that type of effect before.
Can you see through the black glass into the interior?
No, it was fully opaque. As we approached it, though, that's when I stepped off measurements of the craft. It measured approximately 9 feet long. That's three long steps with my stride. And approximately 6.5 feet tall. The fabric of the craft was completely opaque. It was glass-like. Occasionally, you would get some movement of color throughout the fabric of the craft itself. Sometimes a small glob that was probably 6 inches across the color, sometimes 12 inches across, but they were very sporadic color.
These were circles that would change their size from something like 6 inches to maybe 12 inches when they moved over the surface of this dark black glass?
That is correct. It's hard to describe, but I think what stands out in my memory is the blackness of the craft. The best way to describe it, if you took an onyx stone and you had an onyx stone that measured 9 feet long and 6 feet high, that's what you would see.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, to say the least. It was very unusual.
Were you thinking at that moment, this is not from Earth?
I knew that it was not from any form of government. I mean, no Air Force on Earth. No, it was beyond our capability.
Did you say to John Burroughs then, this looks like something from outer space?
I looked at John and I said, I don't know how in the hell we're going to explain this.
And do you remember what he said?
John says, we have a UFO here. I says, we have something here. I said, I don't know. But I said, I got to have quiet here. I got to have some quiet. And I did do the walk around the craft at that point in time. And as I walked around that craft, I already paced it off. This is my second or third time I was walking around it, mainly in awe. Toward the one side of the craft, there was markings on the craft, which were very unusual. They measured probably 2.5-3 feet wide. There were a series of etchings. That's what it seemed like to me, like they're etched in the fabric of the craft. They felt that way to the touch anyway.
And when did you touch it?
Second or third go around, I was walking around the craft. The first time around, I did measurements of the size. Second time, I was looking for compartments or crew compartment or a window or something. And it was completely void of all that. It was a completely smooth surface. Since there was no indication that there was going to be anything hostile from it, it was doing absolutely nothing. It was benign at that point. I consider it was not a threat to the base itself. As I walked around examining it, I was looking underneath. I touched it, and the feeling actually for that, the air temperature out there at the time was probably, 34 degrees, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very warm to the touch. I would say, if I had to guesstimate the temperature, I would say it was probably like 60 degrees.
And you were feeling heat and what else?
Smoothness of the craft, trying to figure it out to feel like glass. But it can't be glass. It's got to be metal, at least with my experience. The craft would be metal, but it felt like glass. I was confused at that point because nothing in my training or in my past experience prepared me for what was going on. As I felt my way around the craft, I came upon the symbols that were on the craft, and I gave them a lot more attention, feeling each one, and then recording them in my notebook.
You've dragged your hand across the surface of this dark, glassy, triangular craft, and you put your fingers inside each of these symbols that you've drawn in your notebook.
Put my fingers on top of them. There was no indention. They just seemed like an etching on the craft. If you had a sheet of smooth glass and you took a piece of sandpaper and you laid it on that glass and running from the glass surface to the sandpaper, that's how it felt.
Oh, so it is not engraved in and it's not raised as much as it is a different surface texture.
Correct.
And when your fingers touch the symbol, did you have anything come into your mind in terms of thought or image?
Well, that's the part I just don't really know when it happened, but yeah, there was, did I feel an intelligence? Yes.
Did Did anything go into your mind in terms of picture or thought?
None that I recall. But here's something that is odd. I lost track of John for like 45 minutes or so. I don't know where he was at. But I don't know if it was because I was mesmerized by what was going on in front of me or what. There was like a 45-minute gap of time there, which seemed like, I don't know, a couple of minutes. I don't know what caused the distortion.
John Burroughs cannot remember seeing you drawing in a notebook. He cannot remember seeing you touch the craft. He cannot remember seeing you photographing. And you did have a camera and take photos, correct?
Correct.
What do you remember about that period when you were photographing?
You know, I took as many photographs as I had in the camera, and as fast as I could, walking around the outside of the craft. They were before the first walk around.
So the first thing you did was take the photographs?
Yeah.
And did you walk around the craft when you took the photos?
A partial walk around. I did probably 90 to 160 degrees.
How many images were there?
I believe there was 36 on the roll.
This was 35 millimeter color negative in December 1980, correct?
It was black and white. I was going to use that if there was a crash scene.
You'd taken it out of the truck where you left Kabansack?
Yeah, I left the truck with it, yeah.
And if the very first action that you took was to use the camera with the black and white negative film in it to photograph this very unusual object in Rendlesham Forest, and John Burroughs does not remember you photographing, it means that John Burroughs was apparently not aware of what you were doing right from the beginning of your time close to the craft.
We were together. I don't have an explanation. What we were seeing was out of the ordinary. You know, and John was agitated, but it's understandable. I mean, he was excited, agitated from the time at East Gate all the way out there. I had more experience, been to a lot of crash sites.
When is your very next memory of John Burroughs?
When the light on the craft started to generate to a more white, brilliant light is when I backed away from the craft. John was maybe 15 feet away, 20 feet away, standing there.
Because you were afraid of what was happening with this increasing light?
I wasn't sure what it was going to do. I don't know, explode, or I was concerned.
So both you and John are on the ground flat.
Right, on the prone position, yes.
And then what happens?
The craft lifted off the forest floor, went to treetop level, and took off at an extreme rate of speed, and John and I stood up at that point in time. Nothing that I know of could be gone in a blink of an eye.
You remember recalling some mental impression or word thought that you relate to touching the symbols on the triangular craft?
Well, it was very hard to sleep at night after that, especially in the following 2 weeks. And I had this feeling, and the feeling was that there would be a return sometime of that craft. I don't know, it was just a very odd thought.
Standing next to Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston in the mystery of what happened in Rendlesham Forest, December 26th to 28th, 1980, was former United States Air Force Airman First Class John Burroughs. Not only was he there with Sergeant Peniston the first night of December 26, 1980, but he was back in the Rendlesham Forest two nights later on December 28, 1980, when Colonel Charles Holt was also out in the forest. John Burroughs was born in Bloomington, Illinois in 1960 and joined the United States Air Force right after high school graduation. He received orders to go to RAF Bentwaters, England, and arrived in July 1979, about 18 months before the highly strange encounters with lights, beams, and craft in the Rendlesham Forest. During that time, John worked as an Air Force police officer and says nothing strange ever happened until after midnight on December 26, 1980. That's when he joined Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston and fellow airman Ed Kavancak to investigate blue, red, orange, and white lights glowing in the forest. Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston remembers approaching the lights, seeing a solid, black, glassy, triangle-shaped craft on the forest floor resting on tripod legs. He photographed, measured, and drew sketches in his notebook. But John Burroughs, who was there with Peniston, does not remember any of that. Later, Jim Peniston realized that his notebook's timeline had 45 minutes of missing time. Further, Airman Richard Bertolino on Bunker Hill was listening to Sergeant Peniston's radio transmissions until security control called for radio silence about an hour after Sergeant Peniston and the other men went into the forest. John Burroughs recently talked with Lieutenant Fred Moran, who said radio silence was requested because security control lost all radio contact with Sergeant Peniston for about 45 minutes. Right from the beginning, the men saw what they could not explain, and something happened to the minds of those eyewitnesses, either in the forest, in later military interrogations, or both. The results have been blank or confused memories. Even the two men, Sergeant James Peniston and Airman John Burroughs, who were right next to each other in Rendlesham Forest between RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, do not remember the same details. Here now is John Burroughs picking up in 2009 about his frustrations with his memory and what he still remembers.
The hardest part for me is that I remember certain things. I know what I remember. I know what my statement says. I know that what I drew was what we came close to. That part I definitely remember. The stories over the years with them coming out and saying I jumped on something, I was drawn into something. Could have been the night with Peniston, and it could have been the third night when I was out there with Colonel Hall. How much missing time? I do believe there was some kind of distortion in time, and it was very interesting under hypnosis to confirm something did happen to me, and I had some kind of interaction with whatever was out there.
And we're still trying to get further breakthrough to see if you can remember more details.
Yes. The hardest problem I have is I spent 26 years in the Air Force. And what happened over those three nights, we did not follow proper procedures and protocol. Things that went on do not add up. The things that went on afterwards don't add up. We were in the largest tech fighter wing in the Air Force. We were at a frontline NATO base that if war broke out, our aircraft would proceed over to Germany and bring other aircraft in for another mission. We had some officers that all went on to very distinguished careers in Space Command, and all of them are sitting there trying to tell us that, well, we really didn't have anything to do with it. Something did happen. We were good men doing a job, but we can't really comment on it.
Jim Peniston made the comment that it appeared that the base commander then, Colonel Conrad, must have had a lot more information than he ever shared with you and Jim Peniston when both of you were asked to see first Lieutenant Moran, the shift commander. That went in a kind of perfunctory way. And then a couple of days later, or maybe by December 29th, you were asked to go and talk to Colonel Charles Hault, and he asked both of you a lot of questions, but then you walked across the hall to the base commander's office. Colonel Conrad, he asked you and Jim to sit down and tell him what you had seen, and he never asked you a single question.
Right. Something did happen off base. We were out there for three different nights. Something did happen around the weapon storage area. I do know the radio traffic was recorded through the command post that night. And I believe to this day that Captain Verano came forward and said a tape was sent over to Germany. And I believe that was the actual tape of the radio traffic that night. And if that tape was ever to be released, I still believe it's out there. That would blow this case completely wide open.
The very fact that what was happening in the towers and being recorded has never been released, that's a cover-up.
Right, because the tape didn't get destroyed. What took place off base and what took place in the area of the weapons storage area, that tape was listened to. And I've also been told that the NSA has files on the incident and they have different documents there. So my best bet is the tape is sitting at the National Security Agency and the fact that it would confirm a lot of what's been said, and it would clearly show that there was some kind of strange phenomena going on over the base. Colonel Hall's tape shows that something very strange happened.
Those audio tapes that would have been done by people who were in control towers would be extremely valuable as the running timeline of events as they happened those three nights. Further, it might explain why Colonel Holt told Peter Robbins when he was working on the book Left at Eastgate in the mid-90s that he knew for a fact that a beam had come down into the RAF Bentwaters weapons storage area and had gone through soil, metal, and cement and interacted with nuclear warheads.
I do know that a C-5 came in Sunday night. It involves the weapons storage area. It was parked. It had its own security.
And John, you're talking then about the 29th, the 30th, the 31st of December after the three nights of events.
Yes, the plane came in on Sunday night. I do know that on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I was posted on the East Gate. I do know there was activity in the woods all 3 days. I did see a chopper lift something out of the woods and bring it over to the Woodbridge flight line over by the 67th ARS, which was pararescue on Tuesday night. So I do know there was stuff going on afterwards. I know there was people in the woods. I was posted on the gate, and I was told because I was involved in the incident, I saw strange things, that that's why they put me there. And then if I saw anything strange happening in the woods, not to call it in on the radio, they were well aware that there was activity going on in the woods.
And they meant don't go through radio traffic, call us on a phone line?
Yes.
They wanted to keep a low profile if anything more happened in the woods.
Right, or anything that I saw going on.
Control of the phenomena was already starting to kick in. Whether you knew what was happening at higher levels of authority or not, you were already being told, do not call on the radio, call on the phone.
Yes, that's what I was told. To me, we weren't taken care of. I mean, we were out doing our job. General Williams, he has said that. We were good men doing our jobs. We were not taken care of. We should have all been checked out because we had something strange happen to us. So medically, we should have been brought in and checked out. We should have been debriefed on everything that happened to us. People have said they've been interrogated, which I don't understand why guys doing their job would be interrogated. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
The fact that Staff Sergeant James Peniston was asked to do sodium pentothal hypnosis and that it lasted for 3.5 hours.
And that's totally wrong.
Can you describe how you got back into Rendlesham Forest and what was your interaction with Colonel Holt?
We saw something like light, really bright and white, and it came down and started hovering out in the distance in the forest. He asked me, was that what we saw the first night? I told him I wasn't sure, and I asked him if I could move forward to get a better view of it, and he cleared me to go forward with Bastenza. Bastenza had a radio on him, and I went towards the object.
And this is Sergeant Adrian Bastenza. You have been given verbal clearance by the Deputy Base Commander, Colonel Holt, for you to go forward toward the now reddish-orange light in the sky with Adrian Bastenza. What happens?
We're in contact with the WSA tower. Adrian and I were running towards the object. Adrian went down to the ground, and I got closer to it. And the next thing I know, I don't know how long it was afterwards, I'm standing in the field right when I got close to whatever it was, and it's gone, and I'm just standing in the field with Adrian behind me.
And what do you say to each other?
Well, I come back towards him, and he told me that whatever it was came over the top of me.
Did he see you rise up into this object?
He didn't tell me when we were out in the field, but when I talked to him on the phone a few years later, he said, yes, it appeared to be that I was pulled up into the sky. And he also told me that he didn't fall down. He was knocked down and something held him to the ground.
And this would explain all of the rumors about you either jumping on the craft or being taken up in a beam of light into the craft.
Yes, it would. I've always felt that when those rumors came out, it wasn't the first night with Jim and I. I went in hypnosis to try to figure out what happened.
Something as dramatic as Adrian Bastenza being able to tell you later that he saw the reddish-orange light come over you and that you appeared to go up into it. Charles Halt and everybody else must have known what happened to you and Bastinza in the forest.
He was behind us, so I'm not sure exactly what he saw.
And you have a memory loss, a missing time on that early morning hours event with Adrian Bastinza on December 28, 1980.
Yeah, there's definitely something. I mean, when I got close to whatever it was, I have no idea what happened. Also, I have spoken to the guy that was in the tower that night, and he did confirm what I'm saying is true. He remembers talking to me on the radio. He remembers me getting close to the object. He also remembers clearly that he said he could see the object hovering over the woods. And he said the object was there for quite a while.
And Adrian Bastinza, as far as he's concerned, went prone to the ground in a defensive move.
He said he fell to the ground, but he claims that he was pushed down. Something forced him to the ground, held him to the ground. He never went down to the ground on his own. Something forced him to the ground.
Adrian Bastinza saw you rise up into this reddish-orange light, not the blue light. Why do you think that Staff Sergeant Peniston, in early February of 1981, a full month after the events in Rendlesham, that OSI asks Staff Sergeant James Peniston to come in for the sodium pentothal hypnosis? Why do you think they focused on Staff Sergeant James Peniston and not you, the person that Adrian Bastinza says was taken up into this light?
Colonel Hall, he clearly told me that he knows I was brought in. He knows I was interrogated. He knows who did it, what was involved, and everything else. I don't remember it. So I'm not trying to say I wasn't. Just what I honestly remember was I never was brought in.
And if the point of the sodium pentothal hypnosis sessions was to block or erase the memories of men who actually encountered something of extraterrestrial origin or time travelers or from other dimensions, it might explain why for 30 years you have been haunted by not being able to sleep easily and having dreams/nightmares, and that your mind is trying to remember in spite of the efforts of the United States and the British governments to block your memory.
It's very welcome, because, I mean, the thing that sticks with me is that under hypnosis, most everything I've said comes out. There's just more to it. I can't describe what Jim and I encountered as good as Jim can. So there's a ton of discrepancies on what we saw and what went on. And as Lord Hill Norton said, it had to be a defense significance. He could not understand how all this could happen and that men were out doing their jobs and that so little would be commented on by either government and the way it was handled by either government.
And why is it that the then Prime Minister of England, Margaret Thatcher, would tell Georgina Bruni, a journalist working on a book, yes, it happened, but we can't tell the people? And that was the title she used for her book. What is it that Margaret Thatcher and the various need-to-know agencies in the United Kingdom and the United States know about what happened in the Rendlesham Forest, December 26th to 28th, 1980, that the rest of the world cannot know?
That's a good question, and OSI and NSA needs to explain what their involvement was.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.